Welcome to What Goes Around podcast. My name is Anne Frankenstein.
And my name is Eamon Murtagh.
Before I say anything else, if you enjoy this podcast, if you've listened previously, or if you plan to enjoy the podcast we're about to present you with now, tell your friends about the podcast, like the podcast, write a review. Everything you can do to help publicize this pod is really, really helpful because we want it to reach the right ears. So hopefully you'll like it. I think in anticipation of how much you're going to enjoy it, you should subscribe to the podcast right now.
Yeah. And if you haven't already subscribed to the podcast, then you should subscribe to it now.
Right now. Go do it now.
just in a never-ending series of moments that stretch out to infinity, the next moment is the one in which you should subscribe. But we digress. Anne, what is on this week's show?
Well, we're going to kick things off with my defense of Britpop, which is kind of a polarizing thing to say, but once we get into it, you'll see what I mean.
Yes, indeed. It's an interesting subject from two slightly different viewpoints. And I will be talking about DJ gigs, which are sort of coming back and sort of going away again. It's a bit of a push-me-pull-me week for the upsetting life of a freelance DJ.
What an absolute tease. And sharing her phonographic memories with us today is the incredible, inimitable Jo Wallace of Ramrock Records. She is such a delight to speak to. A real card, as we say back in the old country. Eamon, shall we get into it?
I think we should. This is going to be a great one. Let's do it. So, Anne Frankenstein, please tell us what is going around in your world and why do you need to get it off your chest?
Is this LBC now? LBC for music. Very annoying.
Someone a very annoying question in a very annoying way, and they're going to completely disagree with it, and then we're going to talk about it for
don't
four
forget
hours.
Then I've got to compare it to the Premier League. Don't forget the football analogies.
And the first person to mention Hitler gets a red card.
Well, someone may mention Hitler in this conversation. I wanted to talk to you. I know we've done many make me believes about certain polarizing genres of music, for example noise we did, jungle music we've done, thanks to some amazing guests. So we're used to covering these polarizing genres of music, but I don't think we've been quite brave enough in terms of how far we've gone, because I think music is a very personal thing. Like, you know, people use music as a representation of who they are. A lot of people who love music tend to be proud of the fact that they're super open-minded. But there are some genres that just get completely dismissed without any credit that I've come across. And one of those genres of music is Britpop music. Everyone universally seems to shit all over Britpop without giving it any credit for anything.
I'm surprised you say that because, like, to me, Britpop is like the most standard in ordinary land out there where the boys and girls live that I don't talk to. The Britpop is just, it's like, it's Britpop Stone Roses is like, it's the rebellious music for people who aren't terribly rebellious.
But I'm not talking about indie music or like baggy music. I'm talking about the Britpop movement. I'm talking about me being 11 years old in 1996, having, you know, cutting out a picture of Menswear and putting it up on my wall. Why do I have to feel ashamed of that? I mean, it's not something I would listen to now. I just find it amazing how much ire it's treated with. Because for me, I was born in 1985, and so I came of age right in the heyday of Britpop music. Select magazine was still around then. I used to read Q and Mojo and Smash Hits, and to me it just seemed, it was the first kind of movement that I'd really been cognizant of and been old enough to be involved in. And obviously it was a revivalist thing, but that led me on to all kinds of other great music that I never would have discovered. I started listening to The Who and The Small Faces, which led me back through to older blues music, Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters. And it really, I credit it with introducing me to a lot of the music that I came to love, music that I still love now. It was a real portal for me. And I'm sure it was the same for a lot of people. I think the fashion was really cool. You know, people like Jarvis Cocker. The Pulp A Different Class was like the first album I ever bought. I bought it on cassette when I was like 10 or 11. And the style, I'd never seen anything like that before. It kind of set me off on this path to being a really kind of committed retrophile. And I just find it hurts my heart a little bit that people are so so dismissive of it because it was a real gateway drug for me, and many others, I'm sure, who dare not come forward.
I don't really see this as the Britpop massive being an oppressed minority at all. I think very much in the majority, Ordinary Land is full of people who like to sing along to Oasis at top volume. And I think Britpop has problems for me, probably because I am a little bit older. Mm-hmm. It was by far the least interesting thing that was happening in the country. There were so many amazing, brilliant, fantastic things that were happening then that were brand new. That for me, even though, like, cause I love my retro music and I like the odd song by Blur and I like the odd song by Oasis. I'm not like absolutely heartfelt against it, but my point would be that as a movement, it was very, very constructed. Mm. And the quality bar was all over the place. I mean, sure, I would never go into this conversation and aim my ire at Suede or Pulp. You know, they came out of it with honours and they did themselves proud. And I would never take away from, you know, the fun of the whole Blur Oasis thing. That's great. But when you start slipping a bit further down the chain and you're listening to Sleeper and Dodgy and Echo...
Hang on, Sleeper? You put Sleeper on your list with Louise Werner, one of the fucking coolest women of the 1990s.
Just boring coffee table indie. Boring.
But it wasn't boring to me. Like, to me, it's like, that was a movement to me. That was like the first... This music was revelatory. Like, I had no frame of reference for it. So it was completely new to me. And the way they performed on stage and their clothes and their hair and everything else. Like, to me, it was... To me, this was like a pop culture revolution. That's what I guess I mean. I feel like it doesn't get... People are extremely dismissive of it and it doesn't get the credit. I'm not saying that I'm looking back at it wistfully and thinking, man, that was so great. But I feel like it doesn't get that much credit as a movement. People are very dismissive of it.
Personally, I think it gets too much credit.
You're talking about people who still kind of look back with nostalgia and like listen to Oasis, like boneheads who just want to fucking, you know, sing along with Wonderwall at a festival or whatever. Like, that's not what I mean. I mean more like a sort of cultural turning point.
The idea was sold to you as a youth. The idea was sold to you as this, there was this rock and roll thing happening and it was, you know, fertile ground for you because once you'd heard these kind of retro styles of music, it did open up into a world, and the way they were dressed and stuff opened you up into a world where there are other great things to explore. And that's all fine, that's great. But when I try and think about what I would, you know, term a real movement of music, a real exciting moment, something that really changes things profoundly in music, I don't think Britpop did change things very profoundly. I think what it did is it kind of brought back an old mentality and it kind of brought back a sort of nostalgia for how rock and roll used to be. And I think that's fine and I can totally understand it because there was so much electronic stuff going on at that time and everything was so new that a lot of older people felt totally alienated by it, and a lot of younger people were still, you know, they're still brought up on their mum and dad's record collection or whatever. It was just, to me, I can understand why people would enjoy it, but as someone who was a little bit older at the time, the selling of the branding of Britpop seemed really contrived, and I thought the quality was all over the place. And I thought, really, the most important thing for me was it ignored all of the innovation and the amazing things that were happening elsewhere in music that I just found a million times more interesting. I mean, great, I love your catchy guitar jangle jangle sound, and I love your rhyming shining with lining and king with thing and, you know, all that, and I like your mockney cockney girls and boys and all that business. That's all fine, right? But none of that was new to me. None of it was new. Jungle was brand new, never existed before. You know, a few years before that, techno and house were coming out in a way that I'd never heard those sounds. Rave was completely off the planet. And if you go back further, things like bebop was so hard and so different to what had come before. Rock and roll was so different to what was allowed to be played before. And even the jazz, when it came over here, it was so different. None of those things were really reviving an older scene. Mm-hmm. Or if they were, they were taking it and absolutely deconstructing it and putting it back together again. Whereas I feel as talented as all these musicians were, and I don't pretend that any of them are without merit, I just think most of that era of music that is called Britpop, a lot of it is bereft of new ideas. They have traditional ideas. It's almost like folk music to my ears. Because at the time, I would have rather listened to Massive Attack or Goldie or, you know, any number of interesting smaller genres. I think the reason it became such a thing is because it was a media creation, and the media wanted a Beatles and Stones scenario because they could get their teeth into that and they understood it. And they were flailing at the time because all of the cultures that were popping off all over the place, we didn't need them. We didn't need the media. The jungle raves happened without it. The techno raves happened without it. There was like maybe two pages in the back of Melody Maker or something. But most of the rest of it was pretty ignored. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And so we got resentful about Britpop. That's how I felt.
Yeah, that's interesting to hear you say that, because like I was just so... I wish I could go back to being that naive, do you know what I mean? I am at the stage in my life now where I am constantly... You can constantly trace one thing back to another thing, do you know what I mean? Like, I feel alienated from brand new stuff, and then I feel bored and jaded of things that seek to copy other things. I feel like I can hear old music in a lot of the music that's being put out now, and I guess maybe that's what I valued so much about Britpop, is that it was unfamiliar to me. You know, it led me back towards all the things they were taking in. And also, I wasn't cynical in the way that I couldn't spot that it was a media construction. To me, it just seemed, I didn't really know or care where it came from, and I didn't understand what the music industry was or why something would be in a magazine as a priority over something else. So I guess it was my naivety as well that makes me look back on it as a happy time. But we can all agree that Justine Frischmann is a style icon.
Yeah, she was cool. There are lots of bands who were kind of thrown in with it that I do like. You know, I did like the first Lasker album a lot. I even like the second one a little bit. Mm. I absolutely loved Pulp all the way through. But, you know, for me, Pulp, they weren't really a Britpop band. They'd been going for 10 years nearly.
Yeah.
So why are they a Britpop band? That's rubbish. They're just a great band that happened to mature at that time in the mid-90s.
Well, they rode that wave, didn't they? I mean, they were put into that Britpop category because of Jarvis Cocker's style and everything else. And so I guess that's just kind of the wave that they rode in on.
A band like Pulp had already made an amazing back catalogue of great stuff, and they hit their prime, and yeah, he was great copy and the Gallaghers were great copy. But, you know, again, Suede had already done a masterful album before the Britpop thing. It was just the press that kind of made Suede part of that narrative. As a matter of fact, it was probably that Select cover that made the whole narrative, you know.
What a great magazine.
Yeah, it was a great magazine, and they were great times, and I do have sympathy for people who are into it, and I think it's great. What I meant was, when I'm being a bit dismissive of it, I understand it means a lot to you, and there's some great music involved in all that, but it was, in my eyes, a step backwards, not a step into the future, and that, and the ensuing kind of mania, and how that brought all these absolute dweebs out in their fucking denim jackets and, you know, parkas with terrible sun hats. You know, that was not where it was.
I would be highly unlikely to sit down and actually listen to something from that era. Highly unlikely. I mean, if it came up on my shuffle or something, I would listen to it. It's not stuff that I listen to with nostalgia. But I guess it's just interesting talking to you about it. Because it came to you at a time when you're a lot less naive. And for me, I guess it's more that I was getting frustrated with not being able to cite it as like a significant influence in my life. I mean, it was only a couple of years that it was at the forefront of my taste. And then I went on and got into Frank Zappa and all kinds of other weird shit or whatever I was listening to then. But that was my gateway. And it would be nice to be able to credit that without a bunch of middle-aged DJs jumping down my throat about it.
Now, I do try not to get involved in conversations around it, because I don't like it. I don't like a lot of it. I have my reasons for not liking it. But I know it makes a lot of people, some people fucking live for the blue tones. I don't get it. I just don't get it. You know, some people think Cooler Shaker are the most overlooked band in the last 50 years. I don't get it. Spare a few big acts, maybe I could count them on one hand. There is not a lot from that scene that I would ever wish to listen to again. I just wouldn't, even if it was on the radio, I'd be looking for something else. Do you know what I mean? Just awful.
Eamon Murder, what goes around?
Well, what goes around at the moment is that the ice of the iceberg is finally starting to melt and small cracks are appearing and gigs are once again washing up on my island shore like little tiny bottles of hope bobbing on the ocean.
These metaphors, this and the bad butter, these metaphors.
They're never going to beat bad butter. We should start a blues band called Bad Butter.
That's another project for another time. Focus on the pod. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Well, just saying, you know, it seems like things are beginning to melt away now. I did have, I've had about two or three outdoor gigs, and I was supposed to, and I'd been blessed with the weather, blessed with it, I say. But then, unfortunately, the last one I did got rained off, or didn't get rained off, but it might have been, there was lightning in the air. Anyone could have died. We had to stop. But then the very next night, word from the booth came to me that the law has once again changed now, and the Musicians Union are put out things saying, well, you can now have musical acts indoors.
It all seems very arbitrary, doesn't it? I'm curious to see what the outcome is, and I will be paying you a visit at the next gig you play there.
Well, hopefully we'll just meld that piece straight into So, we asked you to come along and find out what was going on while I was hard at work.
I'm also hard at work. Although Vox Pops are more like fun. So it's about 10:30 at night. I'm wandering through Hackney Wick. These are the ambient sounds of Hackney Wick you can hear. I'm here because I'm curious about what it's going to be like in a post-COVID age where people aren't really allowed to dance. It's going to be very strange, and I'm looking forward to seeing Eamon DJing again. I can see him through the window. That's the sound of sweet soul music coming out of the hops. There's my pal Eamon. Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay. A little bit strange, but it's all right. There are people here. We are playing inside, and there's no dancing.
Yeah, so I was just explaining. I've been rambling a little bit. Well, I was rambling on my way here, and then someone came out of the shadows and pinched my bum and ran away.
Still got it. Still got it.
That was my first thought, and then obviously I was deeply offended.
Yeah.
But anyway.
You know, take it as the shallow compliment is. It was probably not intended to be.
All right, I'm going in. That's the sound of Dawn Penn, played by my dear friend Ben, who I haven't seen in a long time. Are we hugging? I got a mask on. Legendary soul DJ, purveyor of many 7-inches, DJ Ben. How are you?
Yeah, good. I wouldn't say legendary. But...
Well, you're a legend in my eyes, especially because I haven't seen you in so long. I think the last time I saw you, I was on a really bad Tinder date and I bumped into you in a pub. I think I was trying to give you some kind of eye signals, like rescue me. But yeah, unfortunately, I didn't get rescued. What's it been like for you not playing gigs over the past 6 months?
It's been pretty hard. I've really missed it. Definitely missed Eamon. You know, 4 months stuck inside has been pretty crazy.
He's missed you as well. He talks about you a lot.
He's an angel, isn't he?
He's all right. I wouldn't say he's an angel. This is a really nice vibe.
Do you think so?
Yeah, this is lovely. You know how I like, you know, reasonable volume music, sitting down. This is my jam. I do a podcast with the guy who's DJing over there. It's called What Goes Around. And I got the short straw and I'm in charge of doing Vox Pops. Basically, we haven't been able to do any like on location pieces since the start of lockdown. But I'm really curious to talk to people about what it's like to come to a bar like this, where the urge, you know, the...
We were just talking about how
fucking weird it was.
Yeah, well, exactly. Because, like, you want to get up and dance, right? You're not allowed.
I miss having a dance. Absolutely.
What's it like to come to a place like this and have music like this and not be able to dance?
Honestly, perfect. I'm a terrible dancer, but I love drinking, so it's a perfect combination.
Everyone's a terrible dancer, though.
That's true. Some of us just know we're terrible and some of us don't.
Do you feel safe being around other people in the context of like a packed bar? Or are you just kind of over it now?
I think I've been working the whole time.
Really?
So I've been, yeah, I manage student accommodation. So I've been sort of mingling the whole time. So for me, it's like nothing changed that much except that I couldn't have fun anymore. And so for now, I'm like, finally, let me enjoy myself.
You're not into the idea of socially distanced dancing. You feel like the spotlight is a bit too much on you.
It's kind of like saying you into the idea of wearing a condom.
That's very good. I like that. I like that you're, you know, it's true. I wish more people had that attitude. I thought I would come out here to chat to people about what it's like to be in a bar like this with this great music and not be able to dance.
I can't dance on two occasions. One, because of social distancing, and two, because I've broken my ankle and I love nothing more to dance. This is the closest thing I have to it and I'm grateful for it.
Oh, how did you hurt your ankle?
I mean, I didn't break it. Some bitch who's playing tag rugby against me ran into me on purpose and broke my ankle. Yeah.
Jesus! I'm returning to Eamon. My mask keeps slipping down my face. They were nice.
Were they nice?
Yeah, they're loving the tunes.
We have good people here in the Higgins.
I feel like I've been spotted with my microphone now and everyone else is eyeing me up really terrified. I feel like the manager is looking at me like he's going to have to call Celine.
But you know that thing that you get where, like, if someone has a microphone near you, you go, oh, hi!
Yeah, I'm the only person in the world who's like that.
There's got to be someone else here who's real desperate for fame. That guy over there is giving you a long look, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe he's the one that pinched your mum earlier, I don't know.
He could be, yeah. I can't help but notice the people who I was chatting to are now getting up to leave. I think I may have ruined the momentum of their whole night. I just came up and interrupted the good thing they had going on.
Another win for Frankenstein Promotions.
I am terrifying. This is my cross to bear.
And talk to some other poor bastard.
Okay. I feel like people aren't drunk enough. I also feel like the management.
I play records.
That's true.
I'm working.
All right then. I'm working too. I'm just not getting paid. There is a nice vibe going on in here. There's a lot of hand sanitizer by the door. And they're obviously paying a lot of attention to seating people in a socially distanced way. I think if it were left up to the people in here, they probably wouldn't take that much responsibility. But the management are really on it. Podcast with Eamon, and I brought my little Zoom mic because I just wanted to chat to people about what it's like to be in a place like this and not be able to dance. First of all, I don't want to harass any of your patrons without your permission, and also I wondered if you'd chat to me a little bit. Have you got 2 minutes? Okay, cool. So when did you guys reopen?
When did we reopen?
Yeah.
On the 4th of July.
Yeah.
So literally when we could reopen, we were straight open again.
And what's it like, how do you put measures into place in a place like this, where it's usually like absolutely heaving with people, big old dance floor, big rowdy place, how did you feel like you could make it safe for people and, you know, everything else?
Well, the good thing is, because we're in a warehouse, we've got tons of space, and like because we've got the side entrance and the front one, it means we've kind of got like a one-way thing going, which really works. So people can like sit down on their table, not be bugged by other people. And it's kind of like, they can still enjoy the environment they're in.
Yeah.
Like, they can't get up and dance, which, yeah, super sucks. But, like, people are commenting and saying, like, how they not only enjoy being in here and the vibe's really good, but also that, you know, they feel safe and they feel like it's been well thought out. So, like, the, you know, the measures that we put in place, we feel like are really, like, working, which is, you know, great.
So, that was all going very well indeed for about a month. And then the government changed their mind, and now all the gigs for the next 6 months have been cancelled, despite the sterling efforts of the Howling Hops Tank Bar to make it the safest and best place to have a drink and listen to music. I am disappointed.
We flew too close to the sun. Someone did.
Man. Yeah, and we're all icky, ickyrous now.
Indeed.
What we're gonna do right here is go back. way back, back into time.
We have a fabulous guest for you this week. DJ, producer, label owner, talent scout, museum curator, and all-round music obsessive, Joe Wallace. Joe is a woman who's been there, seen it, done it, and as far as the music industry goes, loved it. She has had her own set of decks since before she was 10 years old and broke the mold for female DJs playing all over the world for the past 30 years. She's been a mover and a shaker all her life, popping up at the 100 Club at the peak of punk, shaking down Glastonbury with her incredible Motown parties, and now she runs one of my favourite labels, Ramrock Records, specialising in reggae, hip-hop, jazz and funk, with artists including Ashley Beadle, Greg Blackman, Camila Wahid, Pauline Taylor and DB Cohen, and many more. Jo, we are truly delighted to have you on the show today.
Thank you very much. And you're very flattering, because it's actually been 44 years that I've been
DJing. we have a running joke in this show that no matter how hard I try and get the intro, there's always one thing that I get wrong. So I'm glad I'm keeping up my...
That was in my favour, so I'm almost, keep it in there for appearances' sake. But
44 years, impressive, though. How do you guys know each other? You and Eamon, do you go way back, or do you just know each other through Twitter? No. What's the story?
Oh, it's a very casual affair.
Yeah.
An affair. I did say I'd already pressed record.
It's just the joy of mailing lists, really, that's brought us together.
Ah. It's a promo entanglement.
Oh, yeah. Very good.
Yes. I like that.
Oh, yes.
But yeah, I've been a big fan of Ramrock Records for some time. Mm. And of course, you've been DJing all around the world and doing all sorts of great things. But then I did see the other day that picture of you in the 100 Club, and I just thought, this woman is ice cold cool. It's too good to be true. I mean, really, like, what, right there in that, and then all the beautiful funk, soul, disco, reggae you're bringing out. And so I just thought... You seem to be, because this podcast, we kind of bill it as being a podcast of music lovers rather than music makers. And you just look like a perfect candidate for the podcast. So
I chance me arm on you. Me. Yes. I'm actually in the Getty collection. That's from their archive.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I was snapped inadvertently, probably being really mouthy to somebody in 1979. And I was wearing the prototype Madness t-shirt, let's forget art and let's dance. And that was given to me in the I was in Upper Street in Islington, and they had a boot, Madness were there, and they had a bootload of these t-shirts, and they said nobody will wear them because it's too sweary. And I said, oh, just give it to me. and I stuck it on, and this is absolutely true. A copper stopped me just as before I went in the club. And he said, I'm going to do you for indecent exposure. So I whipped it off and said, that's indecent, and legged it. I was a lot slimmer and a lot fitter then.
That's amazing. I have to find this picture. I haven't seen it. We'll put it up for listeners as well.
It was so cool. It was so cool. And, you know, it showed to me immediately that you're one of these people that just loves music. You know, it doesn't have to be a particular type or anything. It just has to have that bit of truth in it, I guess. That's what attracts me anyway. Mm. So I just thought it'd be a very interesting chat. And it is already. That's one of the best stories you've had all season.
Yes, officer. catch me if you can.
Yeah, man,
I hit 60 this year. So I started when I was 16 and never kind of looked back.
Amazing.
Wow. That was it, really.
What got you hooked?
Yeah. Well... I was working in a record shop as a Saturday girl from the age of 13, so that was 1973. And so I had to go out and collect vinyl. So I used to go down to the local record shop in Rochester, and they had sheet music. And I used to put it, because I do actually have OCD. I can't bear anything not to be in alphabetical order. And so I used to go and put all their sheet music in order. And at the end of the day, they used to say, well, what do you want? And I say, have you got any records? And the lady who ran the shop was really kind, and she used to give me like a bargain pack, and they were in candy pink and white striped bags. And she used to wink as I went through the box, and she'd sort of wink, which meant she'd put a Motown single in there for me.
Oh,
no, bless her. So I just used to give them one of these bargain packs. And that's how I started building up my record collection. And people would say, what do you want for your birthday? Well, it was a no-brainer. Can I have a record token, please? And then I'd skip down to the shop and buy obscure gatefold sleeve Vanguard Blues albums. And they just look at me and think, you're really weird. And then when I got to 13, they said, do you want to work here? And I was like, oh, yes, please. Do I get paid and records? And they said, yeah. So I thought, So I went and worked there. And then one day, I was probably been there for about 6 months, and I came out of the shop, and in Chatham, the town next door to Rochester, it was a big military base. So you had the Army, Navy and Marines, and there were a lot of clubs and a lot of record shops, and the best one was called K2 Records, and they were what was known as a diary shop, and they reported to the top 20. You had to write everything in a little diary that you sold. And there was somebody standing outside the shop, and they went, you, Joe? And I thought, oh, God, what have I done now? And they said, do you want to come and work at K2's? And I was like, do I get to do all the imports? And they went, well, you read blues and soul, don't you? You're weird. And I went, yeah. So that was it. I was. I never went back to the record shop in Rochester.
You're headhunted.
I was actually headhunted. And I went over there, and I started work with a wonderful guy called Jack Pantin, who I'm still in touch with. And him and his brother, there was Malk and Jack, and they had a disco, which was at the Good Companions. And they used to throw out free records during the discotheque. And oh, wow. I've still got my copy of George McRae, Rock Your Baby, that they frisbeed out into the crowd.
That could do you some harm though, couldn't it? Like a sharp bit of vinyl like that coming out your
house. Oh, health and safety didn't come into it, you know. They just used to frisbee it, and if there was any kind of superficial cuts, A&E was only up the road, so you just had to make your own way up there. But no, I mean, you know, I turned up and they just said, right, you're doing all the import stuff. And I went, okay. And that was it. So I was ordering stuff from the States, and, you know, one of my first big sellers was Open Sesame, Kool and the Gang on Delight.
Oh, great records.
And I can remember getting it in on 7-inch. And then, you know, 12 inches after that. And then I went to work at HMVs. You had to pass an exam at Oxford Street. It was the head office. And I got 99 out of 100, and it still remains to this day the highest score of anyone who took the exam in the history of HMVs.
Get in. God, what did you get wrong?
It was, and I will, it is burned.
Has it been eating at you all this time?
Yes, it has, and I beat myself up ever since. It was Baden-Powell, and of course I thought it was, you know, the trick question. Right. And I put down Scoutmaster, and in fact, it's a Brazilian folk guitarist. So I will never, ever forget that. I would have got 100 out of 100. damn. So, yes, I've never liked Baden-Powell since then.
No,
and
yeah,
I'll never
down
buy
with him.
Any of his, yes, I shall never, ever buy any of his music ever. I've boycotted him. So, that's it. So then I worked there for a year, and they put me through the management course, and you had to be given a department, and my first department was birdsong and brass bands.
Wow.
Why did they put you there? Was that to take the piss because you'd gotten done so well at the exam?
No, you had to learn what was on the shop floor. So I was stuck with this horrible section. But as luck would have it, at the Albert Hall, there was the Colliery Brass Band competition, because this was 1977. So I legged it along I said, please, can I have an extended lunch hour? And I ran off to the Albert Hall and hustled all these old miners and said, if you come down to HMVs, I'll give you loads of discount on these rotten old albums. And I cleared the section.
Wow. So that is some business acumen.
Yeah.
And then after that, they said, right, you can have comedy and sound effects. I went, oh, right.
Gee, thanks, mate, yeah.
So, and this is absolutely...
I had a bus like this once.
Right. So, you know, after doing well, you know, in sort of birdsong and brass bands, they gave me comedy and sound effects. So Derek and Clive landed. You know, there is a God, and Derek and Clive landed, and we shifted something like 22,000 units in the first 2 weeks. And Christopher Lee came into the shop, and you had to serve the customer. If they came up and asked, you had to be on your best behaviour. And he came in, and he was in this beautiful Crombie with a velvet collar, very tall, very handsome. And he said, you know, could you tell me where the Derek and Clive album is? I said, yes, certainly, sir. And you had to give the customer the record and then escort them up to the cashiers. And you said, thank you very much. Now the cashiers will take over. Thank you for shopping at HMV. So anyway, as I was doing all of this, all the lads on the singles counter were doing the bat signal and doing, you know, making little fangs out of bits of paper. And I was like, what are you on about? And they said, that's Christopher Lee. And I went, oh, how could I be so oblivious? But yeah, it was Christopher Lee, and he brought Derek and Clive live.
Amazing.
There you
fantastic.
Go.
I see. Yeah. Well, you did your job properly, and those other layabouts, where are they now?
Oh, disgusting behaviour. Exactly.
I love the idea of brass bands and birdsong being in the same section together. What was that about?
Well, it was just all the old kind of Decca and Ace of Spades budget labels.
Yeah.
And they used to bring out all these really weird things, like, you know, the sound of a blue tit on a Wednesday morning somewhere in Harlesden. And then, you know, steam trains recorded in, you know, at Clapham Junction in 1953.
Very patriotic.
Very, very. So, I absorb all of this, and I try and do my best with what I'm given. And then after that, you know, my manager, who really didn't like me, just said, oh, damn you, you know, I'll have to give you what you want now. And I said, well, I want to work in the jazz department. Mm. And the guy, bless him, who ran the jazz department, was a functioning alcoholic. So he had a teapot in the stockroom, which was full of whiskey. He said, I'm just going to top up the tea, dear girl. And I used to have to kind of, you know, stock up on all the Blue Note releases and all the current sort of Japanese jazz that was coming in. And, you know, I was 17 when you know, Ronnie Foster's Love Satellite landed. Mm. And it was just like the Martians had arrived. It was so brilliant. And I bought it, you know, with my staff discount. And I was called into the office and said, you do realise that you've gone over your quota. And I said, well, I'll just eat, you know, Dundee cake for a month. I don't care. And they said, yes, but we're worried you won't be able to get into work because you'll have spent all your train fare. Oh, yeah, there's always that, isn't there? I'll walk. So I nearly didn't get the Rodney Foster album, but I've still got it, and it still winks at me and said, you know, you pulled that one off, Joe. So, yeah.
Glorious. Well, yes. This is the sort of thing we're here for, I think. And I can see already that you're right from the word go. You're totally surrounded by music. And really, like, not in a passive way, you're out there rummaging around and getting things done, which is really lovely. So why don't you tell us about your first photographic memory today, which is Millie My Boy Lollipop?
Yes. I'm the youngest of five. And there's a very big gap between me and the next one. So all my brothers and sisters were kind of mods and modernists when I was four. And Ready, Steady, Go, we didn't have a television until my grandmother had one delivered in a packing crate in a taxi. She lived in Blackpool and we lived in Rochester. And she just thought, you know, we've got to stop all these kids from appearing, so I'll buy them a telly. So we got to see Bewitched and Ready, Steady, Go, which was really cool. And my parents used to go and play badminton. That was their only escape during the week. and my brothers were left in charge of babysitting. And of course, they weren't going to miss Ready, Steady, Go. And they just used to plonk me down in front of it and say, if you tell mum and dad, you know, the teddy gets it. So I remember it was, you know, early 1964 when Millie Small appeared on Ready, Steady, Go. And she broke into a live rendition of My Boy Lollipop, and my world changed forever. My boy lollipop, you make my heart go giddy up. You are as sweet as candy, you're my sugar dandy. Welcome, my boy lollipop, never, never leave me, because it would grieve me.
I've seen that clip, and she does just because she. How old was she then? She was really young, wasn't she?
She was about 15 because she died in. She died this year, and she was 72 when she died in May. And you know, she really was this extraordinary ball of energy. And people don't. They underestimate the power of that tune, because without My Boy Lollipop, reggae wouldn't have got into mainstream. Yeah. And it established Chris Blackwell's Island label, because the funds, he licensed My Boy Lollipop to Fontana because Island weren't set up to handle 7 million pressings, which it went on to sell. And it just, you know, gave them the funds to go forward into the early 60s. And it was extraordinary that this one track captured the imagination of the whole world. And, you know, if you think before then, with the Caribbean population that came over, they had no music to call their own, really. They were still listening to rhythm and blues. They were still listening to mento and all these musical forms. And then Millie comes along, and that's one of theirs. That is a Jamaican girl. She's on, you know, national peak television, and she's just blown everything out of the water. And it must have been an extraordinary moment for people to see them being represented in a very positive and exciting way. And my dad, who we had a very kind of classical music upbringing. I was a, you know, royal chorister, and my sister was a concert pianist. He didn't like any pop music at all, but he watched this and he bought My Boy Lollipop.
When you get the dad's buying it, you know you've done something right.
You've cracked it. But I still play his copy. When he passed, when we went through everything and we found his copy, and I still play his copy of My Boy Lollipop in my vinyl sets. So that's about, you know, one careful dad owner and then me.
That's a lovely thing.
It's so interesting hearing you talk about your upbringing with music and stuff, you know, hearing first off about how you're sort of absorbed into this world of record stores because you were known as someone who was really into, just really into music and really into weird music that maybe other people or other girls your age weren't into. And then obviously you had older siblings who had very strong identities carved out for themselves. How come you at such an early age got so obsessed with music and so obsessed with stuff that wasn't necessarily populist at the time? Was My Boy Lollipop a sort of gateway drug for you? How did that happen?
My eldest brother used to go to a place called The Parlour, which was on the kind of borders of Rochester and Chatham, and all the mods used to go there. And it had this extraordinary neon sign of the Olympic rings and this giant starburst clock, and it used to serve espressos in these little flying saucer cups and saucers, you know. And they had a jukebox, and all the mods there used to think, oh, bless her, you know, she's like a little mascot. Let's give her sixpence to go and put in the jukebox. And I memorised Marvin Gaye's Can I Get a Witness, and I knew exactly which buttons to press. I memorised them. And they used to think I was really cool, and they used to let me sit on their scooters. I mean, I was four. I mean, this is, you know, quite precocious when you think about it. But, you know, I was being sort of given the opportunity to listen to things like John Lee Hooker and Howlin' Wolf, because my brother was at art college and he was already wearing Levi's and Converse shoes and being really cool, and he used to smoke licorice roll-ups.
And wow, those,
you know, and he used to sort of fancy Julie Christie, and so he looked like Scott Walker. I kid you not. Mums used to swoon at the school gate when I used to get dropped off. They'd say, "Is that your dad?" No chance. but he used to just, you know, play all this blues music, which was very hip. You know, the Stones were listening to all this kind of stuff. And so I was listening to Bo Diddley and very early Stones albums. Mm. And then when my other brother came along, he was kind of introducing me to Captain Beefheart and Cream and stuff like that, and actually putting them onto the record players and saying, "Right, Joe, I want you to make a comparison between this record and this record. Which do you prefer?" And I used to have to sit there and review them. I think they just did it to shut me up, you know, because I'd have to sit there quietly listening to both sides to make an opinion at the end of it.
But, dream job, know, really.
Yeah. No. So that was that. And, you know, I never ever thought that there was any kind of difference between people. You know, I never sort of saw an age gap. And when I said quite boldly during one episode of Ready, Steady, Go, "I'm going to marry Marvin Gaye," and my brother said, "There's actually a small problem, Joe." And I said, "What's that?" He went, "He lives in America." It wasn't like he's 20 years older than you. It was like, "He lives in America." But all my brother's mates who were going off on the hippie trail, you know, they were going off to discover themselves and become Buddhist monks. They, you know, they really did become Buddhist monks, used to give me all their 7-inch vinyl. Because they said, you know, "We're not going to need this in Tibet, man." Wow. And so I used to get, you know, that's how I acquired all my vinyl. It's very
so cool.
Yes.
You had a critical, your critical taste, it was almost like it was taught to you. You know, you were sat there having to discern between these two records and which you liked more. I mean, that is so cool. It's like the perfect storm of elements to, you know, build a great taste into such a young person. Well, should we move on to your second phonographic memory then? Because I'm curious about this one. That's the Way of the World. Tell us about this one.
Yes. Oh, it's one of those albums that I was 14 when this was released, and then 15 when I finally got my hands on it, because it was released in mid-March 1975, and I turned 15 on the 27th of March. And I had to, because our shop hadn't stocked it, I had to go to another record shop to order it. And I had to go through the whole ritual of the, you know, order book in triplicate with carbon paper, and you kept a copy and they kept a copy, and you came back 2 weeks later and there was your record. And I'd heard That's the Way of the World on Caroline. You know, I used to listen to the pirate stations, and it was just like being handed the tablets from Moses. It was one of those extraordinary moments when, you know, the portal opens and you know what the meaning of life is. And it was so extraordinary that I knew that whatever happened in the future, this track would be with me through thick and thin. It would be my constant. And I still have the album almost in pristine condition, sitting in the record room. And it's you know, when things have got a bit tough, I just go and stick that on and the world's a better place. It's an extraordinary album. Hearts of fire.
Desire. Higher, higher. To your place.
I think I probably played that track probably 30 or 40 times in a row, and that's when my parents said, "We're going to buy you headphones."
Fantastic.
Good ploy. But, you know, I kind of did a bit of research because, you know, I thought, I'm coming on here, I better know what I'm talking about. And
not necessary.
But it's actually taken, I didn't know this, it was taken from a film with the same name that stars Harvey Keitel.
Wow.
Supposedly related to me. He's in my family tree. That's not relevant to this at all. And you, Joe, you don't have to pretend to be impressed by that.
I'm so impressed.
My mum once told me that he's somewhere in our family tree. That could 100% be a lie.
That's no, good. But I'm going to cling to that. No, it's
well, me too.
For me.
Me too.
Yes. But it was, you know, I kind of thought, you know, when I was listening to what all my friends were listening to, which around the time would have been like David Cassidy and the Osmonds, and then I suddenly thought, is there something a bit wrong with me to be listening to this extraordinary production? You know, Charles Stepney co-produced it. You know, anything that's touched by the hand of Charles Stepney is immediately gets purchased. You know, you can't go wrong with a French horn. It's just so above any production that was out there. And I mean, this is how nerdy I am. When I got the album, I found out that Ramsey Lewis had brought out an album called Don't It Feel Good, and that featured That's the Way of the World. And of course, you know, I have to rush out and buy everything that's a cover of anything, you know, like Call Me. How many copies of Call Me can you have? And That's the Way of the World. I have been on a mission since 1975 to amass every single version, however dreadful, of That's the Way of the World. So if you've got any, let me know. We can compare notes.
I'm wondering, because are they all in their own section, or do you have to go through the A to Z? Because you said you were militant about
that. Have to go through
the A to Z. Yeah, that's what I like to hear.
But then you can cross-reference, and then when I actually have the title referencing, that's okay, they're all grouped together then. But I don't group the albums together. No. I'm afraid I couldn't do that. That would be right against my brain.
Wouldn't get to sleep at night.
Got to have a system.
Couldn't.
How many versions do you have now?
I think I've probably got about six.
Okay, yeah.
There are more out there. Yeah. And there seemed to be quite a lot done in the 80s by people who played alto sax and some trumpet versions. And the other thing is After the Love Has Gone and Can't Hide Love. So don't even get me started on, you know, Earth, Wind and Fire covers by other people. This could be a whole programme.
I'm just thinking, like, we make a playlist to accompany every episode of this podcast with, like, music we've sort of touched on in
it's
the podcast.
Good
or bad. Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, how many versions of these tracks are we going to be able to cram into this playlist?
You'll have to pick your top three and we'll stick them all on.
Damn you, top three.
Top again.
Yes. I mean, if you're interested, there were two at the time. You know, when I've heard this album, it's top of the tree. I can't fault it, and I won't allow anyone else to fault it. And my wonderfully learned friend Daryl Easley said, you know, it's seen as a medication to the rules of living. And the album is nothing less than a spiritual soul masterpiece. So, you know, props to Daryl. at the time of release, Gordon Fletcher of Rolling Stone said, "Lousy production works to this LP's detriment. Morris has surprisingly had the entire album sounding hot." Gordon, what do you know? I'm going to hunt you down and I'm going to find you and I'm going to admonish you for saying such a dreadful thing, because it sounded huge, you know, it was a massive production.
If there was one thing you couldn't throw at them, it would be that, wouldn't it? Because they were huge and polished as well. It wasn't just like a big blash noise. There was placement and real like precision in the production.
Absolutely. And so Gordon Fletcher, you know, think on 1975 Rolling Stone, you were wrong. So I just thought I'd like to point that out to you. Thank you.
Well, so, filed away. Are you planning on someday gathering up all of your covers of that track and of Earth, Wind and Fire tracks and just dumping them on his house?
Yes.
Bury him under them.
Yeah. I'm going to go with a big ice cream van with speakers and just sit outside them and blast them into Gordon Fletcher's house. See, you reap what you sow.
Gordon, your card's marked.
Let us know, because I want to be there with our like boom mic.
We'll cover it. We'll cover it for the pod. Marvellous. Well, that again is a lovely thing indeed. Now, I have to say, I hadn't heard this particular, your third choice. I hadn't heard this track before, despite knowing the Dells fairly well. But what a vocal on this.
Oh, I mean,
just
it's a bit of a sentimental old record, is this.
So Make Sure. Make Sure is the name of it by the Dells,
right? Yes, Make Sure, brackets, You Have Someone Who Loves You. And, you know, it's all about when, you know, the last act's coming on, you have to make way. And when my second cousin is Stuart McConey, and he is actually my family tree, and my mum
made up for pride.
Bona fide.
Just thrown that in. And I went all the way up to Pebble Mill Studios to be on his radio show. So my mum was so excited because she said, "Oh, he's your second cousin and you're going to be on Pebble Mill." No, I'm not going to be on Pebble Mill, Mum. I'm going to be in recording a radio show. So anyway, he said, you know, what would be your all-time ender? Because at Northern Soul Nights, it's traditional to have an ender. You know, and at Wigan, they used to have the 3 before 8. And, you know, Jimmy Radcliffe, A Night With You for the first time, and I Know What My Lips Are For. Long After Tonight is all over. So my ender was Make Sure. And at These Old Shoes, which was a club I used to run in London with Martin Thompson and the now departed Paul Thomas Peter. When Stuart said, you know, it's a great ender, I said, well, I'm going to have it for my funeral. That's going to be the one that, you know, I go behind the big red curtain and then an arm's going to come out with a diamante bracelet and a long black glove waving at everybody. I'll hire somebody. And sort of a month later, I was doing a gig up north, and these guys kind of sidled up to me and said, "Joe, we're going to have Make Sure, because you know you're going to have it for your funeral, and we think that's brilliant, so we're going to have it too." No. So I started this funeral ender cult, and over the years, you know, people have sort of come up to me sideways like little crabs and gone, "We're going to have it, you know, Make Sure when we die," and that's lovely. Thank you.
That is a good one.
Of your life are the best of your life, for you're young and strong and gay. Hearts can easily mend and romance has no end. Time's good to you in those days.
But when you reach grown up age and must give up the stage, when your future looks dim, chances go slim.
Someone to love today. Yeah. part has been played, and you join that parade that started in days gone by. When you're seized by the fear that the time's drawing near, when you must take your bow and say goodbye,
when you must make room for the next act coming on, when your youth and beauty is suddenly gone, when you look back and see that time marches on.
Make sure you have someone who loves you.
Makes it a good ender. Are there different facets that a track has to have to make it a good ender to Northern Soul Night? What is it about this one?
It's the whole, you know, when your youth and beauty are finally gone, you know, it's
that's
cold, but you know, when you're going to shuffle off out into the bright light after an all-nighter, mostly your youth and beauty has finally gone.
That's a fair point. Yeah.
And things like, you know, when your set is done, you must make way for the next act coming on. Mm. So it's always a lovely way to sort of welcome people onto the decks. And it became such a signature tune with me that people would actually sing it. You know, when I'd say, right, come on, you know the words. And they'd all sing, make sure you have to. And so it's kind of been associated with me for years now. And it's a $5 record. And I mean, I never knew this, but it came off an album in 1968 called Musical Menu. And it's got the worst record cover of all time.
There's some stiff competition for that title.
No, trust me, when you have the word Dells spelt out in scrambled egg, underlined with pieces of bacon, and then the Dells are being shaken out of these giant salt and pepper shakers onto the breakfast. That's quite awesome.
Yeah.
Then open the gatefold sleeve.
Oh, it's a gatefold.
Yeah, it's a gatefold, and there's this giant woman inside eating them on a fork.
What
drugs was the art department on? And it was just buried on you know, it wasn't a brilliant album. And
that's a shame, because the cover promised so much.
I know, that scrambled egg enticed me, winked at me. So I didn't know about this album until I was researching for the show. And I went, what on earth? So anyway, Make Sure was also co-produced by Charles Stepney. Uh-huh. And so there's a very tenuous link between Earth, Wind and Fire, co-produced by Charles Stepney, and Make Sure by the Dells, co-produced by Charles Stepney. Yeah. And you can kind of see this pattern emerging. So, you know, sometimes when you listen to North Street Productions, which is the production arm of Ramrock, you might hear the occasional French horn slip in as our homage to the great Charles Stepney.
All the better for it.
I was absolutely blown away listening to it earlier. And it's just, when you get read, there's like, when I think of Northern Soul, I kind of think of like your big stepping numbers, you know, sort of like kind of Get Witness and whatever, when it's just like real four to the floor mayhem. But the ones that really get you are the ones that are just absolutely packed with emotion, and you have to find that right time to play it. Like, and haven't you heard you say that now? I think if I'd been at an all-nighter and you'd have played that track and it'd be the first time I'd heard it, I don't think I'd be able to leave.
No. Well, a lot of people used to cry. I mean,
it's so emotional.
Yeah, well, that's my ultimate goal, is to make grown people cry. there's a wonderful poster that Gavel Rafferty made, and it's called We Love the Music, Even If It Makes Us Cry. And we as a collective of kind of Northern Soul people, have this wonderful thing called beat ballads. And if you want to get into beat ballads a bit deeper, I can give you some notes at the end of the programme to go off and have a little listen. And you will be rinsed. Trust me, you'll listen to something like Hal Miller, Blessing in Disguise, and you'll be weeping by the middle of it. It's brilliant.
I'm salivating at the thought, to be honest.
I need a good weep. I'm desperate for a good weep.
Your tears
after,
are
after
sweaty,
months of being inside, good balling the eyes, yeah. some red-faced action is what we need.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. Beat ballads give you a legitimate excuse to cry publicly, and you could say, it was the lyrics. It was the strings. It moved me.
The Dales do have some crazy lyrics. Like the track I'm most familiar with by them is... Wear It On Our Face, which I think is quite a fabulous
one.
It's just insane. I love you so much. Where can I put all my love I have for you? I'm going to put it on my face.
Yes.
What a concept.
It's got slight rude connotations, but it's the intro.
I never thought about that, Joe. I never considered that for a moment.
Shall I just stop there? But it's the guy with hitting the piano strings with hammers at the beginning.
Is it? Yeah.
What's
the crazy
that all about? Ding dong.
What's your, because I guess there's a sort of stigma attached to the Northern Soul community a bit, because there's this idea that everyone is, you know, the where it came from, so much about cover-ups and stuff, and, you know, being really sort of, I don't want to say snobby. Snobby's not the word I mean, but you know what I mean? There's an association there with sort of wanting to have rarer records than everyone else, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that's a myth now? Is the culture a lot more open as you see it?
No, yesterday, Frank Wilson's Do I Love You demo signed by Frank Wilson was sold for an undisclosed account. I actually held that copy and sniffed the label at one point in his life.
Why did you let it go?
Well, I had my fingers prized off it by someone, a big boy, who wanted it back. But it's quite odd because, you know, when I started DJing, I was going up to Wigan in 76 from Chatham, and there weren't any women in the record bar. Women didn't do that sort of thing. And by the time it kind of got to 79, I was running my own nights. I was saying, look, you know, why don't... I was going up to West Hampstead, where A.D. Crowsdale and Roger Stewart and people like Randy Cousins were DJing at the Railway Hotel. And it was the sort of forerunner to the 100 Club All-Nighters. And... I used to say, you know, come on, let me DJ. No, you can't DJ. Well, I can actually DJ. No, you can't DJ. So it kind of got into the 80s, very early 80s. And I was putting my own gigs on in scout huts and old hotel ballrooms. And people would say, can we come DJ? And I say, no, because you didn't let me DJ for you. So,
yeah, quite
and
right
that was
too.
It. Yeah, so I'm the fat controller, and you're not going to DJ at my night.
You've got some legendary grudges, Joe.
You're 44 years worth of business. There's going to be a few grudges picked up.
Trust me. They will be settled. But anyway, yeah, so that was this whole thing with the cover-up. There's always going to be somebody, i.e., the person who sang it, the engineer, the producer, there's already people that have heard that track, so it's not a secret. And if you dig far enough back into a record's history, you will find these people. It was difficult kind of pre-internet, but now the internet's up and running. You can find these people and ask them, you know, what is the real name of this record? And cover-ups were really funny because people used to, you know, cut pages out of a magazine and stick it over with a bit of glue and try and pass it off as something new and exciting. Well, no, actually, I heard that 3 years ago. And that, you know, what you're doing? It's silly. Stop it. I was mentored by Randy Cousins, and he was the kind of godfather of the London scene, and his vision of what would be played 25, 35 years down the line was prophetic. I mean, it was extraordinary. And he would sit me down and say, right, for 75p, you're going to buy this record. And I sold it for over £1,000 a couple of months ago. You know, and it was that guidance, that without that guidance and being put on the right track, I wouldn't be sitting here talking in depth about a lot of parts of the Northern scene. And there were divides. you know, there were particular sounds played in the north, and in the London clubs, you had the London sound. There was, you know, Alan Hanscom playing at places like the Water Rats, and you had the 100 Club. And then when our club came along, these old shoes, we had particular tracks that you had to come to the club to hear. And then we'd travel, we'd go and do gigs maybe at Cleethorpes, or we'd go to the Prestatyn Weekenders, and people would go, "What's that? Oh, we've been playing it for about 2 years. Wow. It's a, you know, a £10 tune." But this whole thing with cover-ups and, you know, I personally, and this is where I might get a bit sweary, it's called cock-waving. And I don't have one of those. And so I don't have to do that. So I have had big records. I've had the trophy tunes. And you don't need to do it. But, you know, I suppose if you haven't got anything else in your life apart from a suitcase of cash and a bit of vinyl, you've got to have something to wave about, haven't you, and show off about. And they're workhorses. At the end of the day, bits of vinyl get put on the decks. They make people jump about, make them leave the club, make them leave the event with a big smile on their face, and they've done their job. They've transported those voices from 1964 into another time in 2020, and those voices came out of the grooves, and people heard them and thought, "Wow, that's amazing." So they're still doing their job, and that's why I buy records. I don't buy them for an investment. I buy them because I know they're going to make people happy. They make me happy, and I'm just a conduit. I just pass that happiness on to people. And if they don't like it, there's the door, and I throw the refund at them. So, you know.
And add it to the grudge list.
Yes, yeah. Yeah,
that is the very best of attitudes, I think
oh, but you like the DJing oracle, Joe. This is like music to my ears.
Now, before we shuffle off, I also want to talk a little bit about Ramrock Records. Because obviously you've started and done all the homework by going right through the whole Northern Soul scene and beyond. But, you know, I came across Ramrock maybe a couple of years ago. I think it was the D.B. Cohen release.
Oh, right, yes.
Wrong Tom's on it. Yeah, absolutely brilliant. And I think there's a Snowboy mix as well. And that, to me, instantly sounded like a classic bit of reggae. You know, I felt like I knew it for years and years and years. I kind of got into the label through that. And what you're doing is really interesting. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about the sort of three arms of the label and, you know, what your philosophy is of it?
Yeah. Well, again, I am the fat controller. So nothing gets onto the labels without me. I am the A&R department. So that's the bottom line. And I own the labels. So if I don't like it, you're stuffed. So it all kind of started round about 2014, and Adrian Sherwood lives up the road from us, and he had a fabulous Ghetto Priest album and said, "Look, I haven't got, you know, the space or the time to release this. Would you like this to kind of put out?" And I'd previously put out one release, the Ramrock All-Stars, to accompany the Gentleman Rude Boy exhibition that Dean Chalkley put on at Somerset House, and that's where we debuted it with Ox on the Mic. So I said, yeah, it's looking a bit thin on the ground, so I'll have that. And so Richard Epps did the artwork, and we released it, and, you know, it's kind of become a bit of a UK classic. Rodigan put it on as an exclusive, and it was played, you know, on all the best reggae stations, so that was great. And then Greg Blackman came along, and I heard his collaboration with Mr. Bird over and over. And so I licensed that from BBE. And I have a friend called John Oliver, who I worked with when I was on Invicta Radio. He was one of the sound engineers, and he's got DWR Radio. And he said, "Do you mind if I have this?" You know, I said, no, take it as a promo. And about 2 days later, my landline rang, and only three people have got the number. So I went, "Oh, hello," thinking it was my mum or somebody, and it was Tom Moulton. And
oh, wow.
And he went, hi, it's Tom. And I went, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Stop winding me up. What's your number? I'll ring you back. And if it had been like a Ramsgate number, I would have sussed them right out. Anyway, it wasn't. It was a New York number. So I rang him back. And he went,
did you
hi.
Actually do that, Joe?
Yeah,
you're like, thing. I don't believe you. Like your
yeah,
bank trying to scam you or something.
Yeah,
your
I
number.
Thought it was one of my mates really winding me up.
So I rang
him back and he went, hi. So I said, so you're Tom Walton. Great. Okay. And so why are you phoning me today? He said, oh, I've done a remix of the Greg Blackman. And Ash was standing there. Ashley Beadle, my husband, was standing next to me. And he said, who's that? I went, shut up, it's Tom Walton. And he said, yeah, I've done a remix. And I said, well, send the files over and I'll have a listen. So I had a quick listen. And I rang him back and went, oh, Mr. Morton, it's very nice. You know, this is the guy that invented the 12-inch disco
yeah.
remix. I'm talking to this Legend. Man walks on water, okay? And I said, do you think you could extend the middle eight for me and make it a bit longer? And she's going, are you out of your mind? Tom Morton is ringing you, offering you a 12-inch remix, and you're asking him to extend the middle eight. I went, it's my remix.
Yeah.
So, yes. So, and it's Fat Controller. So, anyway, he said, yeah, not a problem. So he went away. He redid the whole remix, sent it back to me, and I said, right, you know, how much do I owe you? And he said, you don't owe me anything. I enjoyed doing this, and good luck with the release. And
wow.
those 300 copies sold out in 5 minutes. Never, ever. I've got my copy. You may hold it and sniff the label. Thank you.
That's enough for me. I'll have that. That's good. Take what you can get at this stage.
So, yeah, that was Ranrock Blue. And then that kind of ticked along and we got lots of lovely people. Tom Glide, the French producer, very big on the soul scene, Grammy Award winner, blah, 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 lives up the road in Ramsgate. It's a hotbed of talent. So I kind of didn't know him and I spoke to him on Facebook and I said, I'll meet you in five, ran down the hill and he was sitting in the coffee bar in Ramsgate. And I said, oh, that Chitty track, please can I have that, Old School Days? And he said, yeah, yeah, yeah. So we did a remix and that came out. And we did Hill Street Soul as well, Soul Train, mm-hmm. and that came out. That was wonderful. And then Margate Soul Festival, which is the My Soul Festival, mm-hmm. Tom got about half an hour with three of his artists on there. So I got to meet all the artists, which was brilliant. And then... a guy called Future Unit turned up in my inbox with this beautiful kind of 90s baggy, trippy, taking a few too many mushrooms kind of track. Very kind of Latin-y, summery. Brilliant. So I had to invent Ramrock Red for him. Because
needs must.
Yeah.
Needs must, man. So that was really good because then Joseph Malik came along. And, you know, when I found, he'd sent out his album, Diverse Part 2, to 10 record labels. And I was cleaning out Ashley's spam trap. And I said, oh, what's this? Oh, I'll have a little listen. And there's a track on it called Love Bound. And I burst into tears. So I rang up Joseph and I said, Joseph, this is extraordinary. You got me at Love Bound. And I said, you know, where are you? He said, I'm homeless at the moment. I'm sleeping on the streets. And he said, you're the only person that's rung me back about this album. You can have it. And I went, right, well, we'll get to that bit, but we'll just get you sorted out with a flat.
Yeah.
So we got all that sorted. And then Joseph delivered this extraordinary album. And I went on to remix Love Bound. And I channeled my inner Wrecking Crew with the marvellous Darren Morris. So that's kind of Ramrock Red. And we've just signed three new acts. The lovely Maxine Scott. She just got a first at uni for music production and she's got an extraordinary voice. And she does kind of neo-soul, jazzy stuff. And then we've got Cherry and the Fever Trees, who are 18. And they're kind of like the Bangles on acid. So they're really good. And then there's a couple of people that I'm trying to entice onto the label. I better not say anything because it might
Don't ruin it on our account.
No.
Don't blow it.
Don't want to make the list.
Keep the cover up, you know, keep the cover on.
Exactly.
So no one knows. And then you can reveal them at the last minute.
Yes. Well, I've got a big bit of news for you.
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
It's an exclusive. You're the first people to hear this.
Ooh. Oh, our first exclusive. I'm stoked.
Ramrock Retro was born today.
Ooh, congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's kind of been like, it has had a gestation period of 9 months, and we have stalked everything, and we've got it all licensed. And the first release is going to be the Gladys Knight tracks that were on Max, Stop and Get a Hold of Yourself, and Tell Her You're Mine. So it's going to be a double A-side.
Amazing.
And then there's some fabulous stuff in there, but you'd have to kill me after I've told you.
Listen,
or is
we'll
it the other way round?
We will be all over that, don't you worry.
Like
we'll be waiting for the postman every day. Bring me that stuff.
Yeah.
Hey, how delightful to talk to you, Jo. We've
had
a really, really lovely time doing this. Thank you so much for coming on.
Mm. You're very welcome.
You're an absolute hero. I think we should. You should be some kind of like musical agony aunt or something. It's been a dream speaking to you. Really,
we'll have a feature. We'll do like, you know, like sort of five
Joe
minutes
says.
With Auntie Jo.
Yeah.
Yes. One bit of advice to you. I used to run a gay night for many years, and a drag queen turned round to me and said, "If you ever get heckled, sweetie, just say is everything else as big as your mouth." I don't think so, and that's worked. So please adopt that if you need to.
Especially in Willie. Waving situations when you're trying to intersect wheelie waving.
Yeah, so that's it really. Thank you for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, likewise.
What a joy.
Thank you.
Joe. Thank you so much for the music as well.
Mm. You're welcome. Thank you.
Wonderful stuff. All right then, bye-bye. Make sure you have someone.